And good morning once again, everyone out in Radio Land all over the world. Really, I mean, when you sit at this mic in this little studio in this northern part of the Land of Enchantment on a night where the wind is howling, literally howling around outside, it's a shade under 40 degrees, but it feels an awful lot chillier. Look, we have a lot to get to this morning on the other side of midnight. That's an interesting term because for a lot of people, it means that's the kind of time of night when we give ourselves permission to think the unthinkable. Well, yesterday something unthinkable happened. The unthinkable was that Elon Musk was able to pull it off. He actually was able to send a rocket into space, into orbit, and drop off 11 satellites en route. And on the way back down, the first stage kind of made a left-hand turn and used more fuel, stopped its 5,000 or 6,000-mile-an-hour climb, came back to Earth, and landed wonderfully softly there in the warmth and smogginess and humidity of Cape Canaveral in the middle of December. And someone is got a mic open. Thank you. Thank you. So this morning what we're going to do is we're going to go into and kind of dissect what this means, because this is not a quiet revolution. This is pretty amazing stuff, given the state of the art for the last 50 years as we've been trying to go into space. This is pretty cool. But before we get to that, I want to talk about a couple of other revolutionary things, and then we'll introduce our guest and we will proceed. I hope you guys are focusing some attention on the primary fights, the election process going on between Hillary and Bernie and the governor, and on the Republican side between Trump and everybody else. We truly have entered the twilight zone in terms of the physics. You know, the aphorism, the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse in public, really appears to be taking hold. I mean, it's astonishing now what the candidates can say about each other, the accusations they can throw back and forth, the language they can use. And it's like there are some Twitters, pun intended, at the edge of the conversation, but most people are just accepting that this is normal. This, folks, is not normal. We are not in a normal election cycle. We're not in a normal period in history. We're not in a normal transition into a future. Everything is beset and besought by uncertainties and ambiguities. And the least ambiguous is that whatever you don't expect, whatever you think can't happen, look again, because it will. And it's going to continue, and hopefully this program will continue to make strides, to make progress, to build numbers. I mean, that's all that it's required to keep the show on the air is numbers. So the more people who join Club 19.5, the better it is for the financial background of the network and for the show and for the future of what we're going to try to be doing. So let me see. What I want to do is I want to introduce my guest this morning, because we have a tremendous amount to talk about. As you know from his previous appearances, Dr. Livingston, David Livingston, is an old friend, a colleague. He is currently founder and host of The Space Show, which in its 10.5 years and close to 700 programs has interviewed an extraordinary swath of people in the nation's aerospace business. It's the nation's only talk radio program focusing pretty exclusively on space commerce and space tourism and the facilitations of our becoming a space-faring economy and society. David is an adjunct professor of space studies at the Odgard School of Aerospace Science at the University of North Dakota. He has a BA in political science, an MBA specializing in international business management, and a doctorate in business administration focusing on space. The dissertation title that he wrote was called Outer Space Commerce, Its History and Prospects. And boy, David, the prospects have just taken a giant leap forward. Welcome to the other side of midnight.
Good evening, and welcome to the other side of midnight yourself.
So where do we begin? I mean, last night I couldn't resist taking a couple of pokes at George Norrie, because George had resolutely, in front of a national audience, told me flatly you know, like a year ago, oh, he'll never do this. And it's like, wait a minute, folks. This is the United States of America. We make the impossible look easy. Look at how this show comes off every night, and you have no idea what it takes to put this thing together and make it look easy. We're a culture that does the impossible, and Musk, you know, has joined that culture. He's an immigrant from South Africa. He became an American and has become an extraordinary American in doing the things that America used to do and used to be proud of doing. And now we look around and we say, oh, my God, how did he pull that off? David?
Well, first of all, I know Elon. I mean, not real well. He's been a guest on my show, and I've met him at a lot of different conferences. And you'd be crazy, and I don't understand why George would say that. Why would anyone who knows anything about Elon Musk bet against this guy? He has a phenomenal record in business of doing exactly what he says he's going to do. He's made billions of dollars for people and his investors in his companies that have been successful. PayPal, for example, was his company. And Tesla Motor Cars, one of the biggest public offerings of stock ever made, and the car is doing very, very well and coming out with new models. And it revolutionized the way cars are sold because he doesn't have dealer franchises and do the things that other dealers do. And they have been really angry about that. You know, he has company stores that work very differently with the Tesla Motor Car. And so it can sell differently, and that's not the subject for tonight. But Elon does things and follows through, and as I say on the space show all the time, you would have to be crazy to bet against a guy like this. He knows how to put together a winning team of people to make the task happen, and he's committed. He can finance his way to doing it. And he knows how to take a vision, even one that is crazy and wild and far out to 99% of us, and turn it into reality. And, you know, people laugh at his plans where he's going to, you know, put thousands of people on Mars in 15 or 20 years. He says he wants to retire on Mars. He wants to build these two huge rockets that are bigger than anything ever built or flown, the Mars Colonial Transfer. So that he can take, you know, just Googles of people are. And, you know, as wild as it is and as much as it defies rational logic, there's no way that I would ever bet against Musk on a business deal. And that doesn't mean he's infallible and he's not going to fail sometime because, obviously, you know, no one's perfect. But to say that he couldn't do a reusable first-stage rocket. He designed the Falcon 9 originally years ago to be reusable and to carry people. That was the original design of the rocket, so that he did not ever have to adapt a cargo-carrying missile-type, ICBM-type rocket to do a different mission, which has been the history of American rocketry all the way since, you know, guided missiles, ICBMs, and the dawn of the space age. We built the space age on military rockets and ICBMs. And Elon did not do that. He built his rocket from the ground up. He built it for humans to fly on it, which eventually they will.
Well, David, and let me stop you there. I know we used at the beginning of the space age, you know, the first space age. We're now into the second space age after what Elon pulled off last night. What makes repurposing a military rocket different than building one from the ground up? And, you know, kind of get down to the nitty-gritty details, because most of us don't build rockets. We get on airplanes, and, you know, we kind of know dimly in the back of our minds, some of us that are paying attention, that the good old 707, the Boeing 707, was originally the Boeing KC-135. It was a military aircraft developed to military specs to refuel aircraft and do other logistical things in the jet age, and it became a repurposed passenger plane with extraordinary capabilities. And I've flown, you know, back when a 707 wasn't actually a big deal. I flew coast to coast for the first time in the good old 707, American Airlines, empty plane because they were just coming back from a strike, and we had four stewardesses all to ourselves for 3,000 miles. Lavishing all the attention and care that American Airlines used to do. So what makes building a rocket from the ground up for people different than taking an ICBM and putting an astronaut like John Glenn on top and firing it off into space?
Well, so an ICBM is carrying, let's just say it's a nuclear ICBM. It's going to carry a nuclear warhead or multiple nuclear warheads. And what it's going to do is use space to arc over and make a ballistic reentry with this warhead over a target, and then deploy that warhead at a certain altitude, whatever they tell it to do, so that warhead does the kind of damage they want it to do over the target. And a spacecraft doesn't do ballistic reentries. It doesn't. It cares about the kind of G-force that it's going to undertake, because some of the cargo may not be able to withstand really high G-forces. An ICBM doesn't care about that. And then the stages separate. So the ICBM doesn't have to work with different stages because it's not sending anything to orbit. So now you've got to stage a rocket, so that stage has to separate, and then it goes to a second stage, and depending on where it's going and if it's a geosynchronous flight and if it's a really huge heavy payload, it may have a third stage that it has to fly on. So when they repurpose a military flight like an ICBM to go on a commercial or a defense or a NASA type of launch, even with a satellite or cargo to the space station, they have to deal with the G-force of that rocket, the kind of trajectory that it was meant to take, and all sorts of other things. Plus, the systems have to be redundant, and on the ICBM, that's not such a big issue because, again, it's going to go into space, arc over, and then come back down on the target. So it doesn't have to rendezvous. It doesn't have to provide a payload and separate it, you know, in space to dock and do all of this kind of stuff. So what they did is they took the rockets and they built on that military framework, and they added to it and tailored it and, you know, redesigned this and did this to make it work for the type of space mission that they wanted it to work on. Now, the Saturn V was not done that way. That was a human spaceflight rocket from the get-go, and the same with the boosters on the space shuttle. But all of our early space launches and satellite launches, you know, were on Titans and versions of the Thor and Delta and other rockets that originally were military rockets. Now, Elon did not do that. He didn't want to build on that hierarchy, and he needed to lower his launch costs. So he built from the ground up with modern welding, modern manufacturing processes that were all computerized. He has a very small standing army because he doesn't need it, because the rocket is so computerized that people can monitor its health and tell what's going on with it and abort a launch and restart an engine or do different things, all because of the computer systems and the digitalization that went into that rocket, whereas a Titan or an Atlas or a Delta, the new Deltas, have big standing armies that are needed to launch them, which is why an Atlas V, which is equivalent to a Falcon 9, give or take, is a $160 million launch, and a SpaceX Falcon 9 is about $60 million.
That's pretty interesting savings.
And that's driving ULA through the bonkers roof because they need to be competitive.
ULA is the private contractor that oversees the launches for NASA from Cape Canaveral.
And the Defense Department, because remember, the U.S. law is that U.S. launches have to go on U.S. Government launches have to go on U.S. rockets. So the two of them are the Delta IV, and then they have a heavy version, and the Atlas V, and then they have a couple of heavy versions for those. And the Delta is even more expensive than the Atlas V. But those rockets have phenomenal track records. So if you're looking for launch on time and incredibly high reliability, like for these NSA security satellites, you know, that cost $1 billion and all of that, the Defense Department wants to launch on the Atlas, and a second choice is Delta because of its higher cost. The Atlas has about 100 successful rocket launches in a row. I mean, it is really just a phenomenal rocket all the way around, but it's got a lot of hierarchy in it that rides up its cost, and causes a higher launch cost. But SpaceX recently got certified by the Defense Department, and it was a very hard fight and a very hard struggle to do this, to launch the national security payloads. And they haven't done any yet, but they're now eligible to do it. So this flight yesterday and the ones coming up early in 2016 are really crucial for them, because if they're a successful flight, then the Defense Department can start using a lower-cost Falcon for national security payload launches of these big satellites. And that will really put a competitive, you know, thorn, you know, where on ULA, because all of a sudden they can launch a $60 million rocket instead of a $150 or $160 million rocket.
Hmm.
And that's a big deal. So ULA, United Launch Associates, has plans to have a reusable rocket and a new rocket, which is much more modern in its manufacturing, using what is known as air launch. This is their rocket called a Vulcan that they're working on, which would be much more competitive with a Falcon 9, but that's maybe 5 or 6 years down the road, however long it takes to build it, test it, get all the bugs out of it, and it would have to get certified by the Defense Department as well, because it would be an entirely new launch vehicle. But that's the approach that ULA is taking to become super competitive with what SpaceX is doing, and this doesn't consider SpaceX's plan to bring out the Falcon Heavy, which is 50 tons of capability, sometime later next year in test flights, although they do have some paid flights on the book for 2016. We'll see if they're able to do that. So it's going to be hard to compete with SpaceX. And while we're talking about it, the European rocket, which is the Ariane 5, which is the most successful commercial rocket in the world, has never, ever earned a profit, Richard, no matter how successful it is. It was government-owned with France and Great Britain and some other players in the European Space Agency. And what they did is they farmed out manufacturing of parts throughout all of the ESA membership, because that's what these countries do. And they've never been able to turn a profit, and they're in a tizzy fit about all of this. So they have restructured their company. They've sold some of the interest, so I think France is out of the picture, and it's going to a commercial company, and they're trying to turn this around to make it a commercial operation. But it's even more successful with the number of launches than the Atlas V. I mean, Ariane is a phenomenally successful rocket, but it cost upwards of $200 million.
Oh, my God. How can they compete then?
Well, because if you've got a satellite that is going to provide all sorts of communication links for a region that is two-thirds of the world, and your customer are 3-4 billion people, what you don't care about the launch cost, because you're going to make so much money on your satellite communication. What you care about is an online, on-time, reliable launch, because any delay costs you money in getting your revenue stream going, and you want to make sure that the launch is going to be successful. And there is no rocket around that has a success rate as good as Ariane. So you say, okay, this is my best choice to make sure that my payload, my satellite, goes to orbit when it's supposed to go and starts earning money for my company when it's supposed to be earning money. And if we have to pay $100 million more for the launch, we'll make that up easily in operations, and we don't have to take the risk of delays or, you know, the loss of the satellite.
So let me ask this question. Why did this take so long in coming? I remember back when I was discussing this on Coast with George, and I was trying to put him in the picture in terms of why. I mean, Von Braun could have done this with the first stage of the Saturn V, the S1C. Nothing, as far as I know, in the last 50 years, except maybe GPS, and even that you could have substituted with LORAN-C or something like that, in terms of knowing where you were and getting back down and landing at a pre-designated launch site. Nothing that Elon did yesterday, last night, had to really be invented. It had to be integrated. It had to be, you know, all the bugs worked out, all the fine responses of hydraulic systems and computer control and all that, engineering. But the conceptual idea of taking a rocket and launching a payload and then bringing the first stage back is not actually that amazing, except no one before Elon and maybe Bezos, we can talk about him later, has looked at pulling this off. And it seems to me, based on your Intelsat model and the Ariane 5, that part of this has to do with the economics. Up until now, it really made no sense to develop a recoverable rocket based on the current technology. And for some reason now we've reached a breakpoint where it does. Why is now different? Why has the last 50, 60 years of space been throwaway and suddenly now Musk is the hottest thing in town?
Well, you hear, and you mentioned the presidential politics earlier in the show. So this all goes into politics and philosophy and all of that. So up until Elon Musk started SpaceX about a dozen years ago, 10 years ago, rockets were built by private companies in America because we don't have government-owned businesses. But
we don't have an arsenal system for rockets for the government.
But the customer was the government.
Right.
And NASA.
But people talk about privatization. What they don't understand, David, is that we've had private spacecraft all along. Every spacecraft built for NASA, for the Air Force, for the government, has been built by a corporation, not by the government in a kind of a Picatinny arsenal.
Correct. But the customer has been the government, and what NASA did and the Department of Defense did is while they use Boeing or Lockheed or ATK to build their rocket or whichever company they chose to build it or their payload, they also gave it the specs on how to build it. Wow. So it was built by a private company, but totally controlled by the government for a government launch, and they were built on cost-plus contracts, which means that we'll pay you X to do this, but if you have cost overruns or delays or you need more money, you come tell us, and we'll increase the cost on your contract. So this obviously, you know, is like giving the keys to the hen house to the wolf, right? And so, you know, the cost skyrocketed on a lot of this stuff. But with the government, whether be it be NASA or be it the Department of Defense, their priority was never to lower launch costs, which is why we have really high costs to orbit. The space shuttle was about $10,000 per pound to go to orbit. And
isn't that more valuable than gold per pound?
Well, let's take a 200-pound guy, and at $10,000 a pound, what would it cost to take that guy up to low Earth orbit? You can get an idea of how valuable that is. But their priorities were not cheap access to space or low-cost access to space. Their priorities were launch on time, be reliable, and don't lose the payload. Send it to the orbit it's supposed to go to. And damn the cost, full speed ahead. And that's what they did with all the spy satellites, with GPS, with all the Air Force stuff that went up, and NASA as well, the NOAA weather satellites. Everything was launched that way. Now, when the private space community started getting organized, which was, you know, later in the 1980s and the 90s, and there was G. Harry Stein, who I know you know about, talked about halfway to anywhere as low Earth orbit, as long as you can get out of the Earth's gravity well.
That was actually Harry quoting Robert Heinlein.
Okay, but what happened is, if they realized that if you want to have an expansion of real commercial business, that means commercial companies build rockets like Ford and GM build trucks, and then you choose whatever rocket or truck you want to fit the job, for example, or you can buy a foreign truck, for example, then you need to have lower launch costs. Well, NASA and the Department of Defense were never interested in lower launch costs. And then here comes Elon Musk. And he wants initially to do a project called the Mars Oasis Project, which maybe some of your people have heard of. And so he wanted to send a greenhouse full of Earth vegetation of a certain type to Mars to see if he could develop some kind of habitable, you know, vegetarian type of life.
So this would have been an unmanned greenhouse sent on a rocket, landed on Mars,
right, so
little panels exposed, you know, and it's doing its thing, and it's got kind of like Bigelow's inflatable spacecraft in Earth orbit, except this is on Mars, and you'd send back pictures, and you'd see plants growing, and daisies flowering, and asparagus blooming, and all that by remote control.
This is what he wanted to do. So he starts trying to find out how much it will cost to buy a rocket launch to go to Mars. And the companies that would sell him a rocket launch to go to Mars were so outrageously expensive that he couldn't make it happen. And that's where he said, damn it, to hell with all of you. I'm going to build my own rocket, and I'm going to do modern manufacturing, and I'm not going to have a standing army, and I'm going to lower the cost of launch. And that's why he went into developing SpaceX, and the rest is history with the Falcon 1 that finally flew successful, and then he had 19 flights of the Falcon 9 before he lost that one on June 28th, and then he had the flight yesterday. So he set out to lower the cost of launch costs, and nobody took him seriously. You know, he had a lot of problems initially with the Falcon 1, and almost all of his launches were delayed, and not because of weather, but because of this, that, or the other. And Mike Griffin, when he was the administrator of NASA under President Bush, then said, what we really need to do is have a shot at commercial resupply of the space station. So that's when they came up with the COTS plan. And SpaceX was one of two companies.
You have to describe COTS, COTS.
You know, the casual definition of it is cheap off the shelf. But that tells you what it stands for. But I forget the official wording on it, but it's about commercial companies doing low-cost cargo-only flights to the space station, so that they could save money and see if the commercial industry could take hold and if it was possible to even develop, low-cost space flight.
Okay, well, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Dr. David Livingston, and we are discussing Elon Musk and the revolution. We're going to get into the revolution and actually what it's going to make possible. In the background, Bobby Bright. Remember, Bobby sent me last week a new album. We're playing a little bit of Bobby Bright this morning. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Heavy life in limbo, got a hold on me. Kites are on the table, playing. Their places, Lord, set me free. Living in limbo, living in hell.
And we are back on the other side of midnight, on the other side of the solar system. You know, what Musk has done really has now catapulted this into the second age of space. David, why don't we describe kind of in some detail what it is he pulled off and why it is such a big deal?
Okay, first, COTS is actually officially the Commercial Orbital Transportation System.
Ah, yes. And by the way, this year, apparently, the Congress funded it fully for the first time since the beginning of the program.
No, they funded the second part of that, which is the commercial crew part, because remember, SpaceX is supposed to be the American rocket.
Oh, yes, yeah, okay,
that,
right.
That takes crew to the space station rather than buying the tickets from the Russians.
Right.
So they funded commercial crew in that new commercial space bill fully for the first time. You're correct.
Okay. So.
Okay. So. So the holy grail in rocketry to achieve low cost space access has been reusability. And since Rock...
So hang on a second. When everybody was standing by and saying, I want to be Buck Rogers, you know, when John Glenn and the other Mercury 7 guys went up, and the Gemini guys, and then Apollo and all that, and we're all thinking, oh, we're next. You're telling me, and you're telling the world through this program, that NASA and the Air Force and none of the other space conveyors had any plans for democratizing space, and it's basically because of people like Musk and Gary Hudson and a few ragged pioneers in the private space group camp who have worked diligently, with Musk being the most successful, to design from the ground up a spacecraft, a booster that can take us up and bring us back and do it like an airplane, and that NASA never had any idea of doing that because it wasn't in their economic interest, and I would venture maybe it wasn't in their political interest to get a lot of eyes up there of people that could not be controlled to see what's really going on.
Well, keep in mind, NASA is the one that started the commercial industry. They jump-started it with the COTS program.
Yeah, but wasn't that really Reagan? Wasn't
no.
Reagan...
Well, the first commercial launch happened during Reagan's period, and it was very cumbersome and went through multiple agencies, and that caused a reorganization of the commercial space part of the FAA that would regulate this to make it, you know, go a lot smoother. And there were sounding rockets and suborbital rockets for scientific missions, and, you know, some suborbital rockets for commercial missions. There's one that flies out of the New Mexico spaceport, and the name of it just went right off of my tongue, but I'll think of it again in just a second. But the really big orbital...
You don't mean Richard Branson's outfit, do you?
No. No. This guy, Up Aerospace, UP Aerospace. So this has its origin from Kai Michelson's amateur rocket that went to space many, many years ago. Kai was the first amateur to ever launch a rocket in the desert that actually made it to space. And I think the head of Up Aerospace, his name is Larson, but don't hold me to that. I haven't talked to him for a long time. They built on that Kai Michelson design, and they have a commercial suborbital rocket that launches out of the New Mexico spaceport with Up Aerospace, and they've launched student payloads on it. Celestis, the space burial company, does their suborbital space burials with people's remains that want to launch them to space on Up Aerospace, and that has been private all along. But the big orbital vehicles, NASA and the Defense Department had as their goal reliability and launching on time so that you didn't lose time with delays, you know, other than maybe weather delay, because American rockets are more vulnerable to weather and wind than, say, the Soviet Union and the Russian rockets were or are. And so I think privatization is the wrong word, but economic launch, the government really wasn't focused on that because that wasn't part of government missions. They weren't, you know, focused on cost, just like government not focused on saving money or, you know, being cost effective in a lot of things that it does. Space was no different than that. But it was Elon, when he wanted to go buy a launcher to go to Mars with his Mars Oasis plan and found out how costly the launch would be and how difficult it would be to buy a launch. I mean, you tried to buy a rocket too and do a plan, you know, your plan years and years ago, long before...
Oh, you mean Harvest Moon, Project Harvest Moon.
And you tried to get a Saturn V and pay for it, and you guys and your team couldn't get it.
Well,
and,
we got to a certain level at NASA, and then it was like something happened, and of course, in hindsight, I now know what happened. They weren't going to allow any civilians near the moon, given what's all over the moon. But we didn't know that back then. We thought it was a level playing field. We thought it was just money. No, it was not just money, David. It was not
money. And all
money.
Of that has started to change. I mean, look, you've got the Google Lunar X going to the moon. You've got Alan Stern's Golden Spike company that claims to be going to the moon. You've got Shackleton Energy, which, I mean, we're off the topic of Elon Musk, but they have plans to do water ice mining at the poles of the moon to turn it into rocket fuel, because you can go to other places in space from the moon, if you have fuel, a lot easier than you can from Earth, because the moon has 1/6 gravity of Earth, and Earth's gravity well is a real challenge to get out of. That's where all that energy and fuel and effort is needed. So, but anyway, Musk decided that he would build his own rocket and figure out how to do this, and he brought modern manufacturing to it. Look, he was using, I remember touring Hawthorne, which is where their main plant is, 5 or 6 years ago, and he was already using 3D printing for some of his parts. I mean, you know, most companies haven't even gone to adaptive manufacturing yet. So Musk is way ahead of everything. He was building his rockets, Richard, without the use of a clean room. I was in the Boeing facilities and ATK facility and other facilities, and you know, they use clean rooms for a lot of their stuff. Not so with SpaceX. They didn't have any clean rooms, and their philosophy was, you know, look, if we can lower the cost if we can make the manufacturing the rocket durable, and you can't make it durable if you got to do everything in a clean room.
How does he get away with that?
He made first of all, he does all of his parts in-house. You know, he's a vertically integrated company, and everything has to be really durable.
But if you have a speck of dust in the wrong place, I just said plate because I'm thinking of relays where plates come together and there has to be a contact surface and you got a speck of dust in there and it's not the right measurement and the computer says, oh, the voltage is off, and so it kills the mission. And in other words, if you don't build them clean, how does he get away with building in an ordinary factory environment?
I'm not the manufacturing guy, but they did not have clean rooms. And
well, that's a huge revolution, because clean rooms and super clean technology is one of the drivers of cost for space. If you have to do everything in a hospital environment, how can you possibly, you know, make it like a Ford, where you do it on a production line?
He figured out, you know, how to do it. Now, I'm sure they keep things clean, and there were areas where we weren't allowed to touch anything and stuff like that. But, you know, that's different than, you know, an air purified, you know, with air blowing to keep stuff away from things, clean room. But I'm just saying he revolutionized rocket manufacturing to get away from these standing armies and all of this.
So he basically went in from the ground up and said, okay, U.S. Army, back in the days of Picatinny when Von Braun was, you know, producing a la Chrysler, but basically it was the Army producing rockets, or Von Braun doing the Saturn V or any of the other. He basically went and reinvented the wheel from the ground up to figure out every place where the costs, doing it the old way.
On manufacturing. Now, remember, he can't do much with the fact that he's building a chemical rocket. So the mass payload, this is, you know, how much does the rocket weigh with fuel versus how much payload can it take? That is not different from...
No, of course not, because it's basic chemical physics, yes.
So that's about 93%. So the payload is about 7% of the mass of a rocket, give or take. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can, you know, cheat here and squeeze here and do this and there and tweak it a little bit. And he tweaked the launcher yesterday by the kind of fuel he used.
Well, 30% is one heck of a tweak.
Well, he went from 1.3 million pounds of thrust to 1.5 million pounds.
That's huge.
And he did that with supercooled fuels.
Yeah.
But also he had more powerful engines, and he wasn't going to GEO, and he had small payload on board. So this was the ideal flight to do this, because that gave him the fuel to come back to the Cape on his flyback.
The margins.
Right. So if he had launched a normal weighing satellite bus, that's what the satellite structure is called. It's called a bus. And if he had been going to launch a geosynchronous satellite up to 22,000 miles, he would not have had fuel to fly back.
So the reason that he can really dramatically cut launch costs is from, you know, 180 million, 200 million down to 60 million, is he's basically gone in and re-engineered every part.
Like the manufacturing and the design and all of that.
Like Henry Ford setting up, you know, production lines for the Model T, Musk went back and evaluated at the basic level every single screw and nut and Intel chip and relay and hydraulic tube and whatever, and he went and he calculated the costs of each one of those and how to drive down those costs in a sustainable, economic, and reliable manner, so when he assembles his vehicle in a non-clean room, it's basically like building an airplane as opposed to building a one-off rocket.
Well, he's still building one of a kind. There's no mass assembly line, you know, or anything like that. And I think it's still, you know, a lot more challenging than building an airplane because it's not mass produced. But yeah, he redesigned how to manufacture it, and he used modern business systems and computer controlled sensors and things like that to cut out the cost of labor, because labor, as we all know, is your biggest component. And if you can computerize a lot of that labor, then you can save money. And so that's how he's doing. He's doing it on business systems and manufacturing because he's not able to change the laws of physics with a chemical rocket.
I'm still thinking, I'm just still fascinated that for the last 30, 40, 50 years, the objective of NASA and the other government agencies has not been to lower the launch costs.
Play it on out. They didn't have competition. There was no compelling force to tell them to lower
launch costs. Well, except for the taxpayer and the Congress saying, why are we spending all this money and throwing the damn thing away?
They weren't saying that. They wanted those satellites and GPS and remote sensing and all the spy satellites that they were launching, you know, way back when. You know, we've been launching spy satellites for decades. They wanted those missions to be successful. And they were assured of timely launches on schedule and of reliable launches that didn't put your payload into the ocean. And for that, they paid, and they were willing to pay, because this was our national security and our national interest. And there wasn't a movement on, you know, to lower launch costs. The voice of space advocates back then was few and far between, you know, wanting to lower the cost of launch and wanting to have a real private industry. Honestly, that didn't start to catch on until mid-90s to late-90s when the advocacy movement and the forces to do all of this came out. I mean, Musk was on my show, I think, the second year I started it with his Mars Oasis plans. That'd be late 2001 or 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And so things sped up, and the culture has changed, and young people are getting into it, and the industry is revolutionized with CubeSats, for example, and small satellites. When I first started going to the small satellite conference in Logan, Utah, which is part of Utah State, there maybe would be 400 people there. Now there's 1,500 people. You know, and they're all there doing business, and a lot of them are doing business with the government, which is also there. So that everything is changing rapidly. It's a fast-moving time we're living in. And if, again, if I go back to your introductory comments about things are not what they appear to be, and our world is changing, and you know, these candidates are a manifestation of the changes that this country and our culture and the world are going through. They're not an aberration.
No.
They're just a mirror image of the speed of which things are happening. And space is one of these areas where it is really on fire right now. And Musk showed that yesterday. And he has put pressure on the government and on the Defense Department and on everybody because of his success in lowering cost of launches. And he's put that in the consciousness of Congress. And many in Congress, by the way, still oppose him and want only to deal with traditional aerospace companies and are willing to pay the higher price because they believe traditional aerospace companies are more reliable. And they're not convinced that Musk is as reliable as what he appears to be in these 20 successful launches. Out of 19 successful launches out of 20.
Mm.
So, but the early days of the Atlas and the Delta, they had losses too. And you probably remember Titan launching national security satellites, blowing up on the launch pad.
Spectacularly, yes, yes.
You know, and we tried to launch, you know, there's a satellite orbiting now called OCO2, which is the orbital carbon dioxide satellite. We put two of them into the Pacific Ocean from Vandenberg, because the launches didn't work because the fairings didn't open up. The fairings are what encloses the payload at the top of the rocket and protects it until it's ready to be inserted into orbit. And they never opened up, and, you know, the rockets went into the drink with the payload. So we lost two orbiting carbon dioxide satellites over the last 5 or 6 years. And they quit using the rocket that was made by Orbital, by the way, before it merged with ATK. Orbital Sciences, they quit using that rocket as a launcher for NASA payloads and for other NOAA payloads.
I just find it fascinating that all those years that we were working in the vineyards, those of us covering space and those of us that knew a lot of space folks and astronauts and, you know, aerospace company engineers and all that, I mean, Jerry Parnell and I would have these long conversations about lowering the launch cost so we could democratize space, and it never, ever, ever, ever happened until a guy named Musk showed up.
Right, and it was never a priority because the only missions that were ever being conceived of and launched were government missions.
Well, I just want to get on the record how amazing Musk is, because he's not just a tinker. He's not just someone who's figured out a better, you know, mousetrap. But he is he's really a one-stop shopping when it comes to integration of the entire manufacturing process, so that the Falcon series of rockets really was designed from the ground up to be reused and to slash the costs, and now we're seeing the results.
And to be a human spaceflight certified from the ground up. So, for example,
you and I can someday go and hang out in lunar orbit because of Elon Musk.
So they want to certify the Atlas V to carry people. So it was never designed to carry people. So they have been working to redesign parts of the Atlas V for several years in order to make it certifiable to carry people. So they have to have...
They being what? Lockheed? Who makes the Atlas?
Yeah, I think Lockheed is on that, and Delta is on the Boeing side.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's the same thing with the Delta. If they want to certify it, they have to make systems redundant. They're not redundant. They have to have an abort system for the crew. There's no way to put an abort system into those rockets. The trajectory that those rockets fly has too much G-force for... you know, for putting some cargo on board and for people. So they have to sort of tone it down in as to how it's going to fly its mission. And that's basically a new rocket. So they end up having to go through all of this and then certify the rocket and test it and do all of this, whereas the Falcon series of rockets is designed for human spaceflight from the ground up. You know, Musk has been testing his abort system at McAllen, Texas, and there are, you can go onto his website, but you can also go onto YouTube, and you can see them ejecting, you know, mock-ups of the Dragon capsule on abort test, you know, for the Dragon and the Falcon 9, and you know, they've been working on abort systems for the Atlas, but they have to remodel the Atlas to do that because it was never designed to carry people, and it won't carry people until it's been redesigned with redundant system sensors that can shut down the rocket, that can abort the capsule automatically, you know, and then abort system. So Musk built that in from the ground up.
Well, he's obviously looking to the future. Why don't we talk a bit about this, you know, Musk-Bezos controversy? Because I know Jeff Bezos is, you know, sending out tweets, you know, welcome to the club and all this. What Musk did last night and what Bezos did a couple weeks ago have nothing almost in common, and lay out why Musk is light years ahead in terms of democratizing the space propulsion systems that we are going to need to get to space someday.
Well, first of all, I find they're tweaking each other to be really entertaining. So I'm actually enjoying it. But so Bezos has a Blue Origin is the company, and it's a New Shepard suborbital rocket, which is going to take people to suborbital space for a joyride. autonomously, by the way, not with a pilot or a crew. You're going to be up there driven by and flown by a computer, which I think we mentioned the last time.
Would you get on a rocket where there was nobody up front?
No.
No. I mean, it's like, you know, the welcome to Bezos Limited, you know, your flight will last so-and-so. Nothing can go wrong.
I wouldn't get in a Google car either. So.
Well, at least with a Google car, you can jump out. But, I mean, the idea of a totally automated space system where there's nobody on board that can take control.
Listen, he believes that the systems are reliable enough to do it. But anyway, his flight is suborbital. So that means the speed that he's going to get to about 2,500 miles an hour, give or take. And that rocket is going to go straight up to 100 kilometers, which is, you know, the general definition of space.
60-plus miles.
60-plus miles, and then it's going to come back down and land pretty much where it took off from. So it speeds. It doesn't have thermal issues of having to dissipate heat. It doesn't. It does go supersonic, but it doesn't incur the stresses that an orbital rocket undergoes, again, because it's going straight up and coming down. So now SpaceX, their rocket has to really get up toward the orbital speed, which is 18,000 miles an hour. So that first stage has to boost it to, you know, something like 12,000 to 15,000 miles an hour, and then the second stage takes it the rest of the way. It arcs out over the Atlantic Ocean at X degrees, and I forget what its trajectory is. But it also reaches something called max Q, which is where the dynamic pressure on the rocket is the highest and can do the most damage. And to many of the early launches, they never made it through max Q. The rocket was destroyed because they didn't know how to build the rocket to fly through that maximum point of dynamic pressure. So that the rocket has to go through that max Q point of maximum pressure on the rocket. It's accelerating unbelievably to 8 kilometers a second or something like that. It has 9 engines putting out almost 200,000 pounds of thrust each, you know, on its journey for 2.5 minutes, because that's how long the first stage goes. And then it's going supersonic. It has to stop in flight. It has to turn around. It has to align itself and on a trajectory to come back to the Cape. It landed at an abandoned Air Force Atlas launch pad that was not used anymore.
And I think the old 78.
Yeah, and so it had to come back from then. It had to go through 3 firings of their engine to slow it down and position it, and then 1 engine fired to bring it down to the pad. And so that rocket...
And if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on Radio with Pictures in the upper right-hand corner, that takes you to tonight's guest page. Under Radio with Pictures, scroll down. Link number 1 is a news story. Here's why the SpaceX rocket landing is such a big deal. Item number 2, if you're in front of a computer, David, we have a still taken by a helicopter. Musk had arranged to have a helicopter crew stationed, you know, kind of aloft at about a 45-degree angle as the rocket came down and touched down on the landing pad. And he got these incredible, spectacular HD helicopter views. We've got a still posted as link number 2 on Radio with Pictures. It's a picture-perfect touchdown on 1 Merlin engine just before he touches back down on the ground.
Right, and it had to slow down from supersonic speeds and survive all of these forces that are on the rocket, which are unbelievable. The guy from SpaceX, for those who were not able to watch it on the TV, said that this was the way he described it. You take a pencil and you throw it over the top part of the Empire State Building. As it goes over the top part of the Empire State Building and starts to come down on the other side, it stops in mid-flight, it turns around, it has to go back up over the Empire State and then come back down to where it took off from, and it's, you know, when you hear a rocket launch on television, they say downrange 600 miles, and, you know, it has to come back that downrange distance.
Well, it was several hundred miles downrange and several hundred miles up when they fired that, what they called the boost back burn.
Whoever
created the title boost back burn basically tells you you're using the rockets to stop all that energy that you put in. You have to take out. You then hover, then you have to move it back toward the Cape, toward the landing pad. That's not very economical, David, is it?
Well, Musk, so first of all, the economics of reusability are unproven. So this is going to depend on what it really takes to recertify and qualify the first stage and rehab it and go through and make sure it's all good and the engines and everything.
Now, I heard a rumor this afternoon that this rocket, this Falcon first stage, is not going to be refurbished and fly again, and I didn't have time to go and pursue why, but it seems to me that's the obvious thing you want to do. You've got it back from space. It's sitting there on the launch pad again. You take it back to the factory or to the, you know, wherever you refurbish rockets at the Cape. You give it all kinds of checks. You take it apart. You put it back together. You X-ray it to see about stresses. You look at the electronics. You look at the heat problems, at the aerodynamic problems. You put it all back together, and then you fly it again to see if flyback actually is economically and engineeringly practical.
I think what I read was that they're not going to fly it back to space, but they're going to use it as a test vehicle. And they're going to, you know, analyze it and tear it down and do all of what you said.
Oh, okay.
But it's going back to Texas as a test vehicle.
I see. Okay.
But they're not going to fly it back into space. And so we don't really know, number one, how many reusable flights the first stage can make. Can it hold up for two? Can it hold up for a dozen? That's an unknown. We don't know what the cost of refurbishing will be. And we don't know the extent of that because nobody's ever recovered a first-stage booster before to turn around and reuse it. So there's a lot of questions that will, set the tone for the economics. And then, again, you need the right kind of flight for using this because you need enough fuel to get back, which means you have to have probably a LEO launch. Remember, these 11 satellites were launched to an altitude of 397 miles.
Mm.
So it doesn't take nearly the amount of fuel and energy to do that it does to put a communication satellite up at 22,000 miles.
Okay, so, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning, Dr. David Livingston. I'll get it right eventually. Sometimes the mouth is willing and the mind is weak. Anyway, we'll be back on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We're going to take Musk apart even more and show how you and I can participate in going into space because of what he's doing. On the other side, we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. You know, during the breaks, actually, we ought to put the brakes on the air and sometimes, you know, forget the program. During the break, Scott and David and I were discussing that the wrong billionaire is running for president. And then I brought up, you know, that sticky little wicket that Elon Musk, being from South Africa, is not a natural-born U.S. citizen. He can't run for president. But wouldn't it be interesting, David, if Donald Trump got really excited about private enterprise in space and did something if he ever became elected?
Yes, it would. I think it'd be exciting if any candidate got excited about doing something in space. But Trump has said it would be nice to be able to do Mars and do these space projects, but we're so bankrupt as a nation that the first priority is to restore economic sanity to the country and then worry about doing things on the discretionary side of the budget, and NASA and space are on the discretionary side of the U.S. budget.
Hmm.
So he has made several public statements about that. Now, whether he would really, you know, act that way were he ever to become president, who the hell knows?
Well, if you're building buildings on Earth, it's not much likelihood that he has any familiarity with building in space, but, you know, once he got in.
Bigelow is a builder, and he wants to build in space.
Yep.
And he has an inflatable space station module called BEAM, B-E-A-M is the acronym. I don't remember what it stands for. And actually that's going to launch on a Falcon 9 flight to the space station later in 2016 and is going to attach to the side of the space station. And this is going to test whether an inflatable module can be successfully used to supplement space on the space station and be used in orbital space.
Mm.
And this is going to be a really interesting thing because that's the material Bigelow is using for his private space stations, assuming he can get an affordable launch for his private space stations.
We have someone's joined us from the audience. Obviously, there's lots and lots of questions. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Good evening. Richard Bob from Washington. Quick question for David. Why do you... launch speed orbital is 17,000 miles an hour, approximately, correct?
Roughly, yes.
Approximately,
okay,
right.
Why can't you go straight up at 1.1G acceleration?
Well, first of all, the best reason why is because there's no way to do it right now. But if you went to Mars on constant 1G acceleration 100% of the time, you'd probably get there in 30 days, and, I mean, it would be an unbelievable trip, but we don't have any propulsion that can do constant 1G accelerations. I guess that's the best reason why right there. And it's talked about as theory, but I don't know of any actual work being done on a 1G propulsion system. I mean, there is work done on Mach thrusters, which Dr. Woodward at Cal State Fullerton has been working on with Heidi for years, and they do think they have Mach thruster movement. This is based on Mach's principle and Einstein, but, you know, that would accelerate at 1G if you could actually perfect it and ramp it up, but they're a long ways from anything like that. But you're correct. If you had constant 1G acceleration, that opens up a totally different world than what we're living in right now.
Okay, excellent. That's my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, so let's go back to what Musk did. He basically has designed a system now that can take us into space and bring us back safely and economically. And what are some of the things that this technology could now be used for that NASA could not do in the last 50 years?
We have zero technology or ways or theories to land a large payload on Mars. And if we ever want to go to Mars for settlement purposes or to do anything big time, we would have to be able to land larger payloads than Curiosity, which is about the largest payload we can land on Mars, and Curiosity is about the size of a VW bus.
Okay.
So
you're saying that aerobraking for much bigger payloads is not practical or has not been researched or something breaks down or what?
It's not practical because the Martian atmosphere densities vary all along the way, and to try to do aerobraking or even a supersonic parachute that would be 10 times larger than what you use for Curiosity would probably not work. So the issue of getting large payloads on Mars is a big problem. However, as Mike Griffin and other people have said, based on the success of Falcon yesterday, they said that this recovery of the first stage and the way Elon did it with the supersonic retrograde propulsion, restarting the engine, you know, in supersonic flight and using it to fly home, is really key to creating a future way of landing large, heavy payloads on Mars. So this opens the door to the technology to actually put a large, heavy payload on Mars, which we can't do right now.
So instead of using the technology, the engineering, to stop a booster in mid-flight, bring it back to the Cape, land it successfully, gently, on the pad, Griffin and others are saying you could use the same technology on a payload entering Mars' atmosphere.
Possibly.
And after the aerobraking portion, instead of deploying supersonic parachutes that would be too big and would rip apart and those speeds and forces and all that, you'd basically deploy a variant of the boost back system,
right?
The rocket system to slow you down in addition to aerobraking, and then to guide you to a pinpoint landing on Mars, just like he did back at the Cape yesterday.
Or maybe they wouldn't use aerobraking, but something else. But
yeah, but you got to take all the energy away, and Mars has a nice atmosphere, and
yeah.
you'd be silly not to use it to take most of the energy away, because you couldn't take enough fuel, David, economically,
to
use
it.
Fuel to burn to a stop, to come to a stop on the Martian surface. You got to use the atmosphere in some creative way to slow you down.
So picture some of these cheesy 1950s sci-fi movies, you know, like Tom Corbett and some of the other stuff that we all loved, and they're great. And you see the rocket coming down, and the engines are firing, and it lands tail down. So picture that on Mars.
Yeah.
And with variations, I'm sure the system that Musk is using here on Earth would be modified. But this opens the door for that technology to possibly be evolved and modified and used to get something big on Mars. And he's shown that it's technically possible to do it.
When Zubrin was doing his plans for Mars, what was the name of the concept?
For Mars.
Mars Direct or whatever.
Yeah, Mars Direct. Uh-huh.
His idea was to send big payloads ahead of a crew, kind of set up a robotic base, you land them all, and then you have your humans arrive, and then the humans will get in one of those space vehicles and come home. That was the thesis of the Mars movie that De Palma did. What was the problem in Zubrin, because didn't he have to use also active rocket braking as opposed to just the atmosphere?
But Bob is also a very big vision, very technical and very creative guy. The problem with Bob is that he doesn't have the means to follow through, and Musk does. And so,
wait. You mean Bob's vision can't be enacted because he doesn't have the money, whereas Musk has the money and the vision.
Money, and he was trying to sell, Mars as a government program, and Congress never bought it, and he didn't have an Earth-based launch vehicle to test things and to do things with. So, I don't know that Bob's ideas would not be valid. He's very bright.
It seems they'd be totally compatible. So why doesn't Musk hire Bob, put him in charge of,
think you hire Bob.
Really?
Lockheed
hired him at one point.
When he was starting out in his career, Bob... Like one of the things that all these guys have in common.
Think of Bob as kind of like an aerospace Admiral Rickover. Yes, he would be prickly as a porcupine. Musk would probably hate each other, but could he get the job done? Does he have the smarts?
I don't know that he has the smarts to get the job done, and he has the vision. And when you hear him give a talk, you're absolutely inspired and motivated. He is one of the most inspiring, motivating people I've ever heard talk in the space.
So how do we get him and Musk together?
Well,
I mean, the fact that they're not appearing on stage and the Musk isn't saying, I'm going to support
Bob.
They have
really strong egos, and they have different visions. And, I wouldn't be surprised that if Musk gets further along in building the big rockets, the Mars Colonial Transfer, and going to Mars, Zubrin would probably see this as his avenue to get to Mars, because he wants to go to Mars, and I'm not sure he would really care how he got to Mars. So there might be a synergy down the road for them, but Musk has been focused on, you know, fulfilling his government obligations with the COTS program and the Commercial Crew program and perfecting the Falcon 9 and the Dragon capsule and the Dragon version 2, which is going to carry people on it, and the Falcon Heavy, which is going to start launching satellites next year, or at least being tested next year. So he has a lot on his plate that doesn't take him to Mars for a while. And Zubrin wants to be in Mars within a decade and believes that we can be in Mars in a decade. And I wouldn't, if Bob had the wherewithal to enact policy based on his vision and his theory, I would not be surprised that we didn't get to Mars in a decade or so. I think, you know, there might be a lot of risk in doing it, but I think Bob's a really bright, capable guy, but he doesn't have the company behind him. He doesn't have the, you know, the political force of lobbying. Like, you know, SpaceX has legal offices in Washington, D.C., because in America, you know, like it or not, businesses lobby government for their advantages. And Boeing does it, Lockheed does it, you know, on the military side of things. You know, the healthcare companies did it, you know, with Obamacare. I mean, this is a big part of how things happen in this country, and you can like it or hate it, but it is a reality. And Bob doesn't have that network. So I think that's kind of the difference there. I think Bob is creative. He's certainly a visionary. He certainly is inspired. And I'm not an engineer, so I can't tell you that his ideas would or would not work. But I suspect if he had a way to act upon his ideas and breathe life into them, we'd be a lot further along going to Mars than we are right now.
Seems an obvious match made somewhere.
Well, they certainly know each other. Whether their egos can work together, you know, the people in this industry, these big-name guys, are really big egos, too. You have to understand, you know, this is a big part of their persona and how they function.
Well, doesn't it come with the territory? I mean, look, if you're really talking about encompassing, conquering, in the old 50s phrase, you know, the new frontier, you got to have an ego, because everybody's going to tell you it can't be done. It can't be done. The first thing you meet in the morning is people saying, you know, it can't be done. It can't be done. You know, we can't do it. It's too big. It costs too much. It can't be done. It can't be done. So in order to overcome the it can't be done a million times a day, you've got to have an ego to basically say, I know how this can work, and you will do it my way, and it will work, and demonstrate that you know what you're doing, and that means a big ego.
Absolutely, it comes with a turf, but it also means you may not play nice with others.
But things get done. Huge projects get done. People don't have to like each other to work productively together.
I'm sure if Trump decides to build a Trump Towers in Las Vegas or San Francisco or L.A., he would get the job done. But, you know, there'd probably be a lot of people that said they don't play nice with him.
See, what's obvious Trump hasn't done is to look at any of the mathematical analyses of the payback from the NASA investment.
I'm sure he hasn't. At least he didn't pop off and make a dumb statement like Mitt Romney did. Oh. About what Newt Gingrich said. I mean, Newt was completely wrong about making the moon the 51st state. But the commercial side of opening up that space economy is a moneymaker. And when Romney said, you know, I'd fire anybody who came to me with a crazy plan to go colonize the moon or open up an economic system in cislunar space or something like that, Trump never said anything like that. And I assume that if you put a money-making venture in front of Trump, he would recognize it and he would want to act upon it, especially if it did not cost the government anything but benefited the government.
Well, look at all these studies. I mean, back in the 70s, we were in the kind of tail end of Apollo. We're looking at the buy-in to the space station and the beginning with Skylab and all that. And I looked at all these economic studies, and I went to Goddard one day, and I asked some Goddard people why they weren't being more bullish on what could happen after Apollo, and they basically had no answer. And the answer seems to me to lie in a very useful collaboration between the private sector and government. Go ahead.
And that did not start until Mike Griffin started the public-private partnership to take commercial cargo up to the space station, that COTS program that I talked about. So that was done about, I don't know, around 2004, 2005.
In that time frame, yeah.
Yeah, in that time frame. So you're talking about however long ago it was where you had those conversations where you tried to buy a Saturn V for Project Harvest Moon, and that was a commercial mission, if I recall.
Yes.
That you were working on and all that.
Well, we were going to go to the moon, and we were going to mine spherules.
Right.
And bring them back and sell them to the Kim Kardashians of the world.
And so it took until Mike Griffin sold Congress, and he barely sold it. It wasn't a landslide by any means, and it was very controversial. And then they sold it not on the cost-plus contract basis. And I don't know if you remember, but for a year, year and a half, there was fighting about the kind of contract they would use, and they ultimately decided on a fixed price and very little government supervision on what the private companies did. And they would have to produce via milestones, and if they met the milestones that they and NASA worked out in agreement to ahead of time, then NASA would pay the next stage of the contract price. But there was none of this cost plus that I described earlier or anything. And this was a huge controversy, because many people in Congress said, oh my God, if NASA can't supervise what SpaceX and what the others are doing, they're going to kill everybody. They're going to blow up a rocket over Las Vegas. Mm. They're going to, you know, all hell is going to, you know, ISIS will come to your door tomorrow morning. I mean, it was some of these things were just absurd. I mean, I remember so well the argument against the kind of contracting, which is nothing more than a different form of government procurement. So make no mistake about that. It's government procurement, but it took on a different form for these commercial companies, and they met their milestones, and history is being made.
Amazing. Amazing. So, all right, let's talk about what we can now use this technology to do. How will it help develop the cislunar, you know, between Earth and Moon infrastructure in space, which will allow people like you and me to someday go up and actually see some amazing stuff? What's next?
Well, I think what's next is that SpaceX is really going to have to show that this is commercially viable. And they have a lot of work to do to see what's involved, as we said, in refurbishing this, recertifying it, requalifying it, how many uses you can get out of it, out of the first stage. You know, can you get 2? Can you get 10? Can you get 20? So we're going to go through a period of a lot of finding out answers to things that are just simply unknown right now, because nobody's ever done it before. But you're probably going to see others trying to come into reusability. So Japan, for example, which launches a rocket that can go to the space station and take cargo up to the space station, has already expressed an interest in designing their future rockets into reusability. So you might see Japan entering...
Wait. You're telling me the Japanese, who were hot to trot on all kinds of imitative technologies, at least for the last 30, 40 years, that they're now only beginning to conceive of reusability now that Musk has demonstrated it can work?
Well, a couple of years ago, but they haven't done anything that I'm aware of yet, but this will probably hurry them up. Not sure what it will do to the Russians. Remember, their rockets are lower cost anyway because of all sorts of things with their economy. But I don't know that the Russians are trying to do reusability with any of their new rockets. The Agora, which is their new one, which is modular, that can go up to heavy lift. It's technology that was developed and planned 20 years ago, and it took them that long to get to test flying it, which they started test flying parts of the Agora system last year. So that, I don't think they're going to try to, you know, turn that around into reusable stuff. Ariane's not planning reusability that I know of, but they're trying to reorganize their company to be able to be profitable and to cut some of the standing army labor cost and the distribution cost, given the way that they work. So I think you will see other players come in to this, but Musk is the driver right now, and there's no doubt about it. If Blue Origin decides to go beyond suborbital and enter the orbital contest, he will carry with him this reusable technology, so they would be a player in this as well. Now, as for cislunar, so now we're talking about the space between Earth and the Moon. So we have no transportation systems for that at all, and that is something that would be needed if we're going to develop this economic system between Earth and the Moon. So
is Musk just aimed at Mars? Is he just thinking he has to develop technologies to get to Mars, or is he actually talking about developing the infrastructure in the between
Mars.
Earth and Moon?
No, Mars.
Just
you know,
Mars.
The space station for his NASA contracts in Mars, and launching satellites for commercial companies. You know, he launches GEO and other satellites, like this mission he flew yesterday had Orbcomm satellites on it, 11 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he himself is not that interested in the Moon or cislunar, from what he said. Would he sell one of his rockets to a company that wants to use it for cislunar or the Moon? I suspect he would. As a businessman, he would do that. But that's not, from what I've read and understand, his personal interest, although that could obviously change. So, but if Bigelow can get space stations into low Earth orbit, then there's an economic value to that, and you would need routine flights for servicing those space stations. And so that would be important. And if you could do that with reusable rockets and bringing those first stages back, that would lower the cost of accessing Bigelow space stations. So I think that if you can open the door up a little way, ingenuity and entrepreneurship will come up with markets and ideas and technology and things that we can't even think of during this radio conversation.
Well, during the development of space, we've always looked at taking everything from Earth up into space, using it, and maybe bringing it back down, maybe reusing what you bring back down. But if you open up the system to include the Moon and the resources of the Moon, it just seems to be a kind of a natural fit between Musk's idea of reusable rocket technology and the idea of reusable rocket fuel based on the huge natural satellite that nature gave us, maybe somebody else called the Moon. It seems to me to bypass that whole infrastructure to go directly to Mars put you back in the stunts and flags and footprints as opposed to developing an infrastructure that will be sustainable.
This is the Moon-Mars debate that is ongoing, probably, and will be ongoing in perpetuity. But I am of the school that we should develop cislunar and use the Moon as a learning base, you know, for living in space and doing all sorts of things.
All kinds of things. I mean, you've got this huge, now we know there's all kinds of resources there.
Yeah, so that is my position, but others, you know, advocate going directly to Mars, and this is an ongoing, you know, debate, as I said, and whether there's any government policy to go back to the Moon or not, I know that NASA does work on going back to the Moon, although there's not supposed to be any policy for going back to the Moon since that plan was killed when the president came into office during his first term. So we'll see if any of this gets back on the thing, but I do think any such effort to go to the Moon and to develop cislunar space, I think we're going to see it as public-private partnerships. I think the days of a government-only big project are numbered, if not over with, and there are going to be public participation as well as private company participation. And that COTS model that we talked about during the show and the commercial crew model will serve the basis of developing an economic infrastructure in space, and I think that's going to be very exciting to see. And I really, Richard, believe that when we see it unfold, there will be markets emerging and uses for space that I promise you we never thought of.
Hmm.
You turn the American, you alluded to it earlier in the show, you turn the American entrepreneurial spirit loose, and you give entrepreneurs, you know, the go-ahead you have no clue what they're going to be able to create and how many ways they're going to make money and what products they will come up with to serve us. And I think it's really exciting. It's like opening up a brand new economy, you know, for the very first time. What did the Transcontinental Railroad do for opening up, you know, business going into the West from the East and all sorts of things? It's kind of like we get to see it all over again, except it's going to be in space.
And we get to play.
And we get to play.
My guest this morning, Dr. David Livingston. See, I got that out right this time. We're at the bottom of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. When we come back, we're going to take your calls. I'm sure you have some questions. And we've got a list of people on othersideofmidnight.com on the guest page tonight under Radio with Pictures. All these companies, NanoRacks, Planet Labs, SpaceX, Blue Origin, Made in Space, Space VR, X-Core, Virgin Galactic, Interorbital Systems, all of these companies now looking to space as the new frontier, the high frontier, to coin a phrase that has been around for a while. Anyway, we're on the other side. We shall see you on the other side. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Not owned by any man. A mountain with a view. We are back on the other side of midnight. David, why don't we limb out, for people who don't live in outer space like you and I do sometimes, why don't we limb out what could happen if Musk's ideas of reusability were applied to developing an industrial infrastructure between here and the moon, using lunar resources, bringing minimal materials up from Earth, you know, into space, and making everything reused? In other words, one of Aldrin's ideas for going to Mars is something called the Mars Cycler, which is this interplanetary cruise ship that kind of orbits between Earth and Mars orbits, and you jump on it with a rocket from the Earth, and it takes you, what, 6, 8, 9 months to get to Mars, and then you jump off, you run it with Mars, the thing circles around, you join it on its next flight when it kind of matches your window of cruising or opportunity or coming home. In other words, if we think of space systems in terms of reusing things, it seems to be that Musk's idea now of designing from the ground up for a system to be reusable, one of his next projects should be, economically, to develop a reusable Earth-Moon tug that would move people and cargo and materials between Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, and the moon and the moon's surface, and that would be the key to developing a reusable lunar infrastructure that would build industrial capabilities in orbit to do anything in space, not just go to Mars.
Well, I don't think that's his interest. As I said, he's got the Falcon Heavy that he wants to build. He's got a satellite company for launching and putting constellations, hundreds of satellites in low Earth orbit. That's headquartered out of the Seattle area. He's got the two big Mars rockets that he wants to start to work on, the Mars Colonial Transfer, and I forget what the other one is called. And he's got Dragon for the cargo for the ISS, and Dragon version 2, which is for human spaceflight. So I don't think that cislunar or the moon is part of his interest space or where he wants to put his attention. Plus, he does go after commercial satellite launch business. That's a real income producer for his company. So I wouldn't look to Musk to be the guy that's going to open up cislunar space unless he has a real change of heart and wants to devote resources to doing that. But he honestly, I mean, this guy is obsessed, and he wants to go to Mars, and he wants to retire on Mars. So I don't really know how he's going to do that. He's got, I think, 5 kids, and I don't know if he ever got remarried or not, but he certainly, you know, has relationships. And what's he going to do, leave everybody behind and go live on Mars to retire out his life? I mean, you know, that's a hard choice for people to make, although I know many are willing to do that just from the number of people that claim they've signed up for Mars One, which will never launch as high as a Southwest Airlines flight. But they're ready to go, and you know, there are hundreds that have stepped forward, you know, wanting to go pave the way to live on Mars. I've talked to a couple of them on the space show, and they're real dedicated to leaving even their husbands and their families behind, for, you know, because they want to do that. So that's hard for me to identify with, but I do understand that there probably are people that would like
well,
that.
Well, I think realistically, remember I also said this on Coast One Night, the whole idea of Mars One way and you're stranded forever, not real, not practical. If you start sending home television and videos and soap operas and reality shows from Mars, and those people say, hey, we need a ride, you don't think that Earth would provide them a ride to come home if the colony can't cut it? It all depends on political will, which gets back to the reusability. What technologies would be available to go rescue a Mars One expedition?
We've done shows about that on the space show, and I actually did some research on what the international practices are to rescue dummies who have gotten shelter. So I'm not talking about rescues where the person is an innocent victim of something that happened, but I'm talking about people that have just done asinine things and then they need the Civil Air Patrol or the Navy or something to go bail their chips out. And so in the United States, we typically will rescue them, and depending on which agency did it, you may get a big whopping bill for it, which you probably never have to pay. On Mount Everest, you have to pay for rescues. And in Europe, adventure people, they usually take out rescue insurance, a lot of them do, that will cover their rescue because there's no assurance that any government or government resource is going to do it. Do you remember a couple of years ago, some teenage girl was lost at sea trying to sail alone between...
I do remember that.
And I think either the Australian or the New Zealand Navy finally found her after a week of searching for her, and they rescued her. So the parents got a $300,000 bill, and I remember the mother was interviewed about the bill, and this was part of my research, and she said, no way in hell we're going to pay that sticket. So they figured that the rescue of their daughter was on the shoulders of whatever tax-paying organization rescued her. And so, but look, we don't have launch on demand, meaning you got a rocket right there on the pad ready to go. It takes, with chemical rockets, about 9 months, 6 to 9 months to get to Mars. But remember, we have a launch window where you can really only launch to go to Mars every 2 years because otherwise it's so far away you can't get to it. And there are all sorts of other quirks like that. So depending where in that launch window cycle you had to go pick these people up from Mars One and where you found a rocket ready to go so that you could make that launch window. I mean, it just seems to me that if you go on a one-way mission to Mars, you cannot expect and really think that there's any way that you're ever going to get rescued. Now, if we had nuclear propulsion, if we had 1G acceleration like that gentleman called in earlier and things like that, yeah, you'd have a much bigger launch window because the distance would be mitigated by the type of propulsion you're using, and maybe you would have extra launches sitting on the pad for launch on demand in an emergency. I don't know. But I don't see how we could rescue someone. We could probably rescue someone from the moon, maybe on a somewhat timely basis. We could certainly pick someone up and rescue somebody from the space station, but they have lifeboats on the space station so that, you know, they can get back to Earth if they have to. Rescue is a big issue, and you know, who would pay for it? And so if there's 10 people on Mars for Mars One and they're from 10 different countries, do all of the countries have to chip in and try to pay the cost of a Mars mission? And you know what a Mars mission would cost, you know, nearly probably $1 billion to go rescue them, assuming you could even pull it off. So you're right, it's not feasible, it's pie in the sky, but it is fun to talk about, and I think somebody will eventually do what they're talking about, but I don't think it'll be this group.
You mean the Mars One group?
Yeah, the Mars One group.
I'm going to have Ken Johnson on. He was actually signed up. He join the throngs to go and become a Mars astronaut. And he got eliminated very late in the cycle, but he got very high up there in terms of the number of people. And he and Fran, you know, basically made their peace, and he was willing to go off to Mars, and she was going to stay home. And that's a very interesting, you know, you wonder whether this is a kind of a CAT scan of the state of marriage in our society and others, the number of people willing to leave their mates and go off to another planet. I mean, it's kind of intriguing.
As I said, it's hard for me to want to identify that, especially if you have children. But I wouldn't want to leave my dog either. So I'm not the one to do a one-way mission to Mars. But listen, there probably are people, but I think they're probably ahead of the time down the road, you know, maybe 100 years, 75 years, that may be.
I just find it fascinating that Musk has got his vision set on Mars, but he's developing technologies that will be incredibly useful in developing the space industrial infrastructure to get a lot of people to Mars, because I don't think dedicated missions to Mars are going to fly, pun intended. I think you have to have, it's like until we had the space station, you couldn't have a COTS program because there was no place to go to and there was no customer that would buy services for sending cargo and crew and materials and all that to and from the space station. The same way, to get to Mars, you're going to need an industrial base in the Earth-Moon system for propellant manufacture on the moon, for learning to live in basically a vacuum condition, learning to deal with dust, learning to deal with problems where rescue in 3 days is feasible, as you said a moment ago, but rescue in 9 months is not likely. In other words, it seems to me that the Earth-Moon system provides the extraordinary necessary testbed to do all the cutting-edge things before you launch out a la von Braun, or maybe some race with the Russians. Back when we were racing people, yes, a mission to go to a distant place and get there first made sense. But now that we're talking about human beings, I mean, even the Russians are talking. Did you hear the other day that Putin is talking about a moon base on the moon in the next, 5 years?
Although they don't have any money to do it, but it'll be interesting to see what they can do. They certainly could do the technology for it. I have no doubt about that. Listen, all is not lost, Richard. So as you like to say, stay tuned, boys and girls, you know, for more to come. So I'm going to throw that back at you. Musk has said that in early 2016, he is going to announce for the first time ever some of the details of his plan to go to Mars and what that will involve. And we may find that his plan to go to Mars involves going to the moon.
See, I was hoping to get you to say that, because I have a feeling that somewhere on his den wall, somewhere in a secret room, somewhere where you press a switch on the third book on the left in the library and a door opens up and a whole pole opens up and Musk whisks down to his bat cave, and there are all these plans for development of the industrial infrastructure of the inner solar system.
Let's see.
And all he's doing is showing us little bits and pieces, because he doesn't think people can handle the big picture all at once. That's what I'm thinking he's got in the back of his mind.
He's going to release, he says, all he said is by early 2016, so we don't really know what that means.
It's a few months away.
Yeah, he's going to tell us what his plans are for going to Mars. So this would involve, how's he going to deal with the human factors, you know, the microgravity issues, the radiation issues, you know, the life support questions, the eye degeneration, all of that stuff that goes on with long-duration spaceflight. Is he going to use the moon or cislunar space or fuel from the moon? Or what's he going to do, and how is he going to do it? And we may be surprised to find out that his plan involves intermediary steps that to do this and that and the other in cislunar space or the moon.
It just seems to me, David, it just seems to me that someone with such vision has got to realize that these one-off missions where you fly off to make an historic event for one time just don't cut it in terms of getting human beings off the Earth. Because remember,
I totally agree with you.
It is Musk who really believes that if something happens to us, this window of getting anywhere else in the system, of living on Mars, developing the system, is going to go away. He talked about World War III basically being a showstopper. Yes, it would be.
Yeah, so, he talked about religious extremism, killing people, and we need to get off the earth.
Yeah, so for him not to have a complete vision somewhere down in the Batcave where he's not shown it to us yet because we're not ready to handle the truth. Remember, up until yesterday, a whole bunch of people, including famous people like George Noory, were saying, Musk will never recover a rocket. So given the lack of imagination at that stage, if he had laid out his vision for the industrial development of the inner solar system, would anybody have believed him?
Well, have me back on when he releases his plan, and we'll go through it.
You got a date, definitely.
Hey Richard.
Yes, Scott.
If I can jump in quickly. Now, we're currently operating in a what currently is sort of scenario. I don't know where David comes down in the terms of, perhaps a big announcement that's going to change everything coming from a faraway and or long ago place. But I wanted to toss that into the mix because so far the conversation has been about what we can currently do or think we might be able to do at some point. But the real game changer would be access to a technology that none of us have ever really anticipated or dreamed of.
Well, where I come down on that is it would be nice. I wouldn't bet on it. I wouldn't plan on it. And I have no real way to address it reasonably other than I'm not a big believer in serendipity or things like that. I think
really?
you have to build on your foundation that you have, and most of development and advances come incrementally, and sometimes you make a big breakthrough and you can, you know, leapfrog over several incremental steps. But I have been hearing for years, ever since I can remember, there's going to be a big announcement about this or that or the other. You know, NASA's going to say this big announcement, or something's going to break about, you know, aliens coming here or visitations or something of that nature. And it never, ever happened. So, look, if it happened, I'd be the first one jumping up on the rooftops, excited and thrilled about it. You know, but I'm not expecting it, and I would not, if I were making a business plan, I would not incorporate anything like that into my business plan.
Interesting. See, what David, you're not privy to is all the conversations that Scott and I have with people we book on the show and guests that do appear and people who call in. There's an obvious, palpable preparation by NASA and the other space agencies to let the human race know what's really out there.
Richard, you've been saying
Hang on. Let me finish the thought.
Yeah.
We have data. We've got photographs. If you one of the things I was going to do tonight was to actually put up the Pluto images and have you kind of go through them with me, and then I thought, that'd be kind of boring for people because they've already seen them. You need to go to a couple shows, you know, a few days ago. Click on the Pluto show, I think, from last Friday, Saturday, and just go through the images as we're going through them as you listen to the show. Because there's stunning, ancient, vast architecture on Pluto. That should change everything. This whole conversation tonight, this morning, should be against the backdrop that we are not alone, that the human race is heir to a stunning ancient civilization which left bits and pieces all around the solar system. Whoever develops the infrastructure, David, to get ordinary people out there to investigate, to probe, to bring pieces back, to back engineer, to explore, to turn on machines, to figure out what the libraries have to tell us that are left out there. All of this stunning stuff is not part of anybody's equation yet, including Musk. When those two realities clash, as they inevitably have to, depending upon what time frame, what is our culture, what is our civilization going to look like on the other side, and will there not be the most incredible, demanding, you know, California gold rush mentality about getting off the earth and getting out there and getting a piece of the action as everybody is rushing to them, our hills, because, oh my God, we're surrounded by astonishing ancient technology and we can back engineer it, we can sell it on the open market, we can make money. In other words, you have the driving force that's been missing in development of space, which is how to make a living out there.
I'll be very interested in seeing any of this happen, but I've been hearing about these announcements ever since I was listening to Art Bell 10, 12 years ago, and they don't ever seem to come about. And, you know, we think NASA's going to make this big statement, and, you know, they make a statement about they're confirming flowing water on Mars. Well, hell, there's been flowing water on Mars, and we've known that, you know, for years. I've got a coffee table picture book with Molinari and who was the other one, you know, Vince DiPietro
and Greg Molinari.
And they've got pictures from Mars that were taken, you know, years and years ago with flowing water parts and stains.
Remember the Viking water spout that's in their book?
Right, and who is our friend that he came to, and I met him, and I think I met him through you, that analyzed flowing water with some young lady, you know, on Mars, and oh, God, I'm sure you...
Oh, you mean Efron Palermo and Jill Palermo. Jill England, yeah.
And so I'm thinking they're making a big deal out of this special announcement. This has been 10 years since these guys and have talked about it, and since I got that coffee table book because I heard the guys on Coast to Coast with Art, you know, years and years ago. So look, and what's his name who has the UFO organization that lobbies Congress all the time? I can't remember.
Steve Bassett.
I mean, you know, he's going to have this big press conference at the press club in Washington, D.C., and nothing ever happens.
You're sounding exactly like George said when he said, you know, Musk will never return a rocket to the Earth.
But the difference is Musk has a proven track record. And
No. Musk had a plan. Musk had a plan, but until he does it, it's just a plan.
Until
NASA makes the announcement of what's really out there, it's all us private guys who are looking at these images and are saying, oh, my God, look at this, look at this, look at this. When that hits the fan, when those two realities clash, David, you're going to see the most incredible revolution this planet has seen for millions of years. The question now remaining only is, when is it going to kick off?
Okay, and so my response to Scott's question is, I don't plan on big announcements like that, wouldn't put it into a business plan, and if it happened, I would be a champion of it and would love to see it happen, but I can't plan on it happening because there's no indication to me that it is going to happen, and if it happens, I hope it happens in my lifetime because I'd love to be here to see it and appreciate it and enjoy it and to you know, find all the value in it that one could find. But as I said, I'm not one who bets on serendipity, although I must confess I buy lottery tickets.
Robin, God, you and your lottery tickets. Okay, is it possible that Musk unveiling next spring, in a few months, next year?
Or whenever, yeah.
Yeah. This Mars synoptic plan is contingent on NASA doing what it has to do at some point, which to announce, oh, by the way, guys, there's stuff out there and we didn't kind of get around to telling you about it, but it's really cool and we're now really wanting to go back and look at it closer.
I doubt it, but if it happened, I wouldn't be that surprised, but I wouldn't bet on it.
I wonder if it's time for a bet.
I think Musk will announce his plan based on what he has determined is feasible and necessary, and he's got engineers now that have been proven their capability and their competence, and he has a dream and a vision that he wants to implement, and he wants to figure out how to make it happen, and his plan will be based on what is it going to take for him to achieve his goal. And I think his plan will be pretty much that way. I'd be surprised if he bases it on something on the order that you're talking about.
Unless, remember, Musk is Musk. Musk talks to everybody.
Who
will turn down the call from Elon Musk? So does Musk have the secret timetable? Does he know what's coming? He's smart. He must be able to look at these images by himself.
I, I'm not connected that well, so I don't know the answer to that. And I guess we wait and see what he announces as his plan to go to Mars. And then can you read between the lines of anything he says? Like, for people who understand spaceflight and orbits and know what they're talking about, does he say things that's not going to happen unless there's something else going on? So what else could be going on? To the average person on the street, they won't be able to detect that. But to people who understand how you move around in space and what it takes, you might be able to read between the lines and figure out that he knows something that we don't know. But I'm speculating. I just will wait and see, and I'm eager for that announcement, and I hope it's sooner in 2016 than later. And I think a lot of people are eager for that announcement.
I think 2016 is going to be a banner year in many directions. Okay, we only got a couple of minutes left in the show. It's amazing how this goes so quickly. There's a whole bunch of companies listed on othersideofmidnight.com on your guest page tonight. Which of those companies are going to benefit first from Musk demonstrating that you can build a reusable first stage rocket?
Oh, boy. Who? Well, I think SpaceX is going to benefit the most.
Okay.
I really do. I think... Well, NanoRacks is benefiting from a different segment in the industry, and they're doing great. So as Musk returns to flight and can start carrying cargo up to the space station, NanoRacks will be able to get more cargo, which are their scientific experiments, up to the station. And remember, he can bring stuff back. Musk has download capacity in the Dragon. Mm-hmm. So I think NanoRacks will probably be an early benefactor of Musk returning to flight on the space station. Let's see, Planet Lab, they launch CubeSats, so they could benefit from return to flight, but I don't think the reusability is an issue for them. I think the reusability will benefit companies that want to launch satellites to higher orbits, but not to geo. I don't think that they're going to have the fuel to do it.
Kind of like the Russian Malonya communication satellite system?
Right, or like what OrbCap did. Remember, there's a rush to launch CubeSats, and there are all sorts of CubeSat projects that are being planned, and they are in the low Earth orbit range, or to the sort of the middle or orbit range. So those are possibilities that could benefit from a much lower cost if Musk actually prices that reusable launch at a significant discount. And we don't know what his pricing is going to be on that either, by the way.
Well, we only have a minute left. Anything you want to say as we wrap this up? Because, yeah, obviously, if he announces his Mars plan for next year, and I'm betting it's going to include Earth-Moon infrastructure development, because you can't have a space industry and people in space without infrastructure, you got to come back on, and then we will dissect that.
Absolutely. And what I would say is it's no longer the space world that took us to the moon, and it is evolving very, very quickly. And there are commercial opportunities, and young people today can actually plan a career that is space-related, or actually in space, and it's a different world, and we're watching it evolve. We're going to watch the creation of an economic infrastructure off this planet with thousands of jobs around the world and economic benefits for everybody, not just America or the countries that are able to get to space, but it'll spread like a virus.
Well, thank you, David. Unfortunately, we reached the end of our morning. My guest this morning, Dr. David Livingston. We've been discussing Musk revolutionary developments. Tomorrow morning, it's our Christmas special. So until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everybody.